Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Robert Kraft suppresses video evidence that allegedly shows him soliciting sex.
Clearly, Mr. Kraft had the means to hire an extremely experienced legal team that knew where the soft underbelly of these types of cases lay, to probe it, to expose it, and to argue it.
Also today, protesters overthrew Egypt's dictator 8 years ago. What's changed since?
That's what I always hear from Egyptians. We don't need any more instability. We want things to be just the way they are. They're happy with, more or less happy with, another authoritarian strongman in charge.
Plus, we've all heard the forecasts.
What is this sunshine you speak of?
Mm. We're going to be adding another day to our month of rainfall.
So what does all the rain and cold mean for your garden? We'll take your calls next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft is looking for another win. Kraft's legal team is asking a court to permanently seal police surveillance video that allegedly shows him soliciting and receiving sex at a Florida spa. This after the judge in the case ruled the prosecutors cannot use the footage as evidence in a trial. So is Kraft in the clear? If the video is sealed, is the case as good as won both legally and in the court of public opinion? And if so, what are the broader implications of a case that called new attention to the commercial sex trade? Joining me now to help make sense of the latest developments is David Ovalle. He's a courthouse reporter for the Miami Herald. David, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. I'm hoping you could start by just walking us through the evidence that prosecutors had, but that has now been suppressed in the case. What do we know about what was on these tapes and how it was obtained in the first place?
Well, the key evidence, of course, was undercover video surveillance that had been secretly placed by Jupiter Police inside the massage rooms of this massage parlor. And so that was the key evidence, and it was an ongoing operation that lasted many weeks. And so without that evidence, the judge ruled that the evidence was illegally obtained and basically a huge invasion of privacy with substandard with basically no standards for minimizing who would be viewed and who would be the victim of this intrusion. And so without that evidence, the case is pretty much over with.
What about in the court of public opinion, though, David? I mean, there's sort of two fronts here, right? And I know that Kraft's attorneys now are pressing to seal the video evidence permanently because there is some concern that maybe it wouldn't be admissible at trial, but that it could still be a public record available for the public to see.
Sure. So, you know, Florida has very, very broad public records. It's just a stark contrast to Massachusetts. You know, virtually most evidence ends up being public when a case is closed, and usually even during the as long as it's been turned over to the defense. Now, of course, there's exceptions for, like, medical records and, you know, certain things that are more sensitive. And in this case, it would normally be public record when the case is closed. But what they're going to ask is, well, since this was illegally obtained, this is illegal evidence, illegally obtained, then it should be sealed from the public. So that's a battle that's separate from what happened. But you know, we'll have to see what happens.
I remember, too, David, that at the beginning of this case, prosecutors had a news conference and they talked about their concern that this might have been a part of a sex trafficking ring. They've since sort of stepped back from that claim and focused only on the prostitution. Did they overplay their hand from the get-go with the sex trafficking allegation?
Well, I think in the context of what they were talking about at the time, it would seem a little more reasonable, only because, remember, there was this actually was born out from an investigation that was in a county adjacent to Palm Beach County, and so it's sort of a spillover investigation from that one. And that one did result in more serious charges, not human trafficking, but racketeering. and other charges. Human trafficking cases in these massage parlor establishments are very, very hard to prove. They're very, very rare. We've had a couple here in Miami-Dade County, and they ended up getting, pleaded down to lesser charges because they're just very, very difficult to prove. At the time, but I think definitely by the fact that they held a press conference, that they kept talking about possible human trafficking, sort of playing up the most serious of allegations that they hoped they could prove. But in the end, it was a lot of work and a lot of hullabaloo over what basically was dozens of low-level misdemeanor prostitution arrests.
And David, I mean, you know the landscape down there a lot better than we do up here. So did you get a sense of whether law enforcement sort of knew that this would be a tough case to win, or are they kind of surprised that this case appears to be falling apart?
Well, here's the thing. If Robert Kraft was not one of the people who got arrested, this would sort of just be like a one-day news thing, and they would get by on basically offering community service and pay some fines to all the guys that got arrested, right? It's kind of anonymous people and these kind of things happen all the time. This one is a little more unusual because of the amount of resources and legal maneuvering they got to putting in surveillance video cameras inside the establishment. But for Kraft having the resources to hire investigators, to hire high-priced lawyers, and to be able to commit to really fighting this, this probably wouldn't have been would not have been a blip on anyone's radar outside of Palm Beach County. So I'm sure they were a little surprised because but when you arrest someone with that many resources, you have to expect the utmost standard of legal defense.
Yeah, they certainly got it. That's David Ovalle. He's a courthouse reporter for the Miami Herald. David, thanks a lot for your reporting today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. For a little bit more on the legal maneuverings in this case, let's turn to Brad Bailey. He's a former federal prosecutor and a criminal defense lawyer now at the Brad Bailey Law Firm. Brad, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Cal.
So we just heard David Ovalle say that the resources the Kraft had at his disposal were a big part of this case. How do you see that? I mean, is this a case where even if the evidence had been gathered in a flawed manner, as the judge ruled, that an unknown person without Kraft's resources might have accepted a plea deal?
Well, that's entirely possible. And somebody who doesn't have the ability to finance a legal defense the way Robert Kraft has might just be willing to fold his cards in the instance of male so-called Johns, but a lot of folks didn't have the same stakes involved here and as much to lose as Robert Kraft does as well. But there's no question that the ability to finance high-powered attorneys who understand the requirements of wiretapping and the constitutional aspects and what must be done really did make a huge difference here.
I see. Brad, help us break down this decision here by Judge Leonard Hanser. He basically came down to the minimization that that David Ovalle mentioned earlier, basically saying that these cameras, these hidden cameras set up in the spa, were rolling all the time and capturing footage indiscriminately. So, for example, there were other men and some women, for example, who went in to receive massage services who did not break the law and were nevertheless filmed in various states of undress. And he says that's unacceptable. I guess what I'm wondering is why that was grounds to throw out all of the video evidence, because we know that there are some other cases where evidence that's illegally obtained is admissible in court. So what's the difference here?
Well, when you say in other cases where evidence that's illegally obtained is admissible, it certainly depends what we're talking about. Constitutional violations and violations of the Fourth Amendment, the right to be free from unlawful searches and seizures, which a wiretap is fundamental. And when we have those violations occurring in an investigation, if they're found and established, usually the result is suppression of evidence. And here, the Judge Hanser essentially said, look, wiretapping, electronic surveillance, videotaping surreptitiously, is extremely intrusive. And so we're going to have to put limits on that. We're not just going to allow you to turn on your monitors and your tapes and just keep them running regardless who you're picking up, regardless of whether or not the folks that are getting captured in the images are engaging in lawful or unlawful behavior. You have to limit it to unlawful behavior. You have to limit it to the probable cause that you established in seeking the warrant for the crimes that you say were going to be committed. And you sure as heck have to instruct, not only in writing and post-written instructions, but you have to instruct the monitors about minimization, when it should be on and when it should be turned off.
So, Brad, I guess what I'm wondering is, I mean, your analysis there makes perfect sense, but I assume that the state attorney, Dave Ehrenberg, knows all of this, right? So when he's presented with this evidence from Jupiter Police, I assume that his office runs this kind of analysis, and yet they decided to bring the case anyway. So is it possible that they sort of knew what they were doing, prosecutors knew that there was a chance this evidence could be tossed out, but felt that maybe there was some greater good to accomplish here, that you, you know, try to hold somebody accountable in the public eye, or you shut down a prostitution ring? Is it possible that that was the calculation here?
Well, Callum, I think that there's the possibility that the state's attorney didn't really have the depth and breadth of experience that is necessary to run a sophisticated wiretap or electronic surveillance. It takes a lot of experience, a lot of training. I've run wires. You do take the time to sit down with your team. You do take the time to put in writing the minimization requirements. You do make sure those minimization requirements are posted at the monitoring site. So one has to wonder whether or not there was a little bit of inexperience here. One also has to wonder whether there was such a rush to turn this into a big case and something more than it really was, that a lot of shortcuts were taken and corners were cut here.
So should the charges just have not been brought in the first place, Brad, or was it worth a case worth bringing to start an important conversation?
Well, I think that folks can come down on either side of that, but as a criminal defense attorney, obviously it's critical that if you're going to do things, you're going to do them properly. And if you're going to be as intrusive and invade privacy, even under a lawful court order, you sure have to play by the rules and stick to those rules. And saying things such as what's said in court, well, we just looked away, and to suggest that the judge would find that was proper minimization is just foolish, and that's why they're in the situation they're in. But it doesn't necessarily mean, Callum, that the case is over yet.
Interesting. Yeah, we'll have to see whether the state decides to appeal or not. That's Brad Bailey. He's a former federal prosecutor, now a criminal defense lawyer at Brad Bailey Law. Brad, thanks a lot for your time today.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Archaeologists in Egypt this week are celebrating the discovery of a military castle that dates to the 7th century BC. It's the kind of artifact that can advance knowledge of the country's legendary history and maybe even teach us something about its current society. Connections between ancient and modern Egypt are just some of what journalist Peter Hessler excavates in a new book called The Buried, An Archaeology of the Egyptian Revolution. Hessler is a longtime foreign correspondent for The New Yorker, who has spent much of his career reporting from China. But he moved to Egypt in 2011, just in time to witness the Arab Spring firsthand. So when he was in Boston for the launch of his book recently, I asked what it was like to experience the revolution as a Western reporter.
Looking at it from afar, we saw it as the rise of a powerful movement, a powerful revolution. But if you were there on the ground, and especially in the aftermath, What I saw it more as was the collapse of a weak state. So it wasn't so much a powerful uprising as a state that had become very weak, a regime that had no succession plan, and it was ready, it was ripe for collapse and for something to knock it over. So sadly, there wasn't the sort of real grassroots movement that you needed to transform a society. And I think it was also a very narrowly political event in a society that could have used a more social revolution, the sort of revolutions like, you know, what's the role of women in this society? Is this something we can change? Or the role of young people? I mean, this was a country that you saw in Tahrir. I mean, it was more than 50% of the population was 25 or under. And these are people that are poorly educated for the most part, have few job prospects. What happens with them? Unfortunately, you know, those questions are still unresolved.
So how do those Egyptians, especially those of that age group, that generation you're talking about, look back 8 years later? What's the legacy of the Arab Spring in their eyes?
I think many people will tell you now, we shouldn't have done it, you know, which is sad. I mean, it's, you know, people will say it was better under Mubarak. They'll often say that, or that was all just a waste. You know, and so they sort of, part of the lesson, sadly enough, that they took was that it's better not to have these sort of movements. I feel like that's the phase they're in. Now, who knows, you know, maybe this will, you know, things take a while to develop, and maybe in 5 or 10 years it will feel different. But now, that's what I always hear from Egyptians. We don't need any more instability. We want things to be just the way they are. They're happy with, more or less happy with, another authoritarian strongman in charge.
So let me back up to your own arrival in Cairo. You got there right around this time, right, in 2011. And before that, you had been the New Yorker's correspondent in China. So how did you begin to learn a brand new place when you first got to Egypt? I mean, what do you do?
Yeah, my wife is also a writer. My wife is named Leslie Chang, and she used to write for the Wall Street Journal. And so both of us, like living overseas, she was also in China for more than a decade. And so actually, when we left China in 2007, we had this idea that we would like to go to another place and study another language and write about another part of the world. And we thought about it a lot, and we decided it was actually either going to be Damascus or Cairo. Those were the two choices. And this was back in 2007, and people told us, you know, actually nothing changes in Cairo. It's very sleepy. It's, you know, Mubarak's been in power for almost 30 years. You may find it boring, and which was fine. We liked the idea of going there and studying Arabic. But of course, by the time we were ready to make the move, the Arab Spring began. And so this unexpected event. And so we ended up going to a country that was very different from what we had expected. And it was very intense. I mean, so we, when you ask what we do to undertake something like this, I think the first thing was really language, you know, and so we enrolled in an intensive Arabic class, the Middlebury summer program, did 2 months of intensive Arabic. And once we arrived in Cairo, we really focused on language. That was very important, obviously, just for understanding the place, but also for safety. You know, I was often dealing with crowds, and you're in somewhat volatile situations. And if you can speak some Arabic, it really helps.
So you mentioned getting there and that you sort of saw the fall as the fall of a weak state, which reminds me of something you write in this book. And I wonder if it's informed by the perspective you gleaned from all those years in China, because you write that, quote, the Chinese saw Egypt for what it was, not for what they hoped it might become. During the first phase of the Egyptian Arab Spring, Westerners usually believed that they were witnessing the rise of a powerful social movement, whereas the Chinese tended to see the collapse of a weak state. So is that where that comes from that Chinese perspective you picked up?
Yeah, it was partly. And this was one of the reasons we went there, is we felt like, you know, you often specialize in a place, but it's nice to have actually three different cultures that you're thinking about and three different languages. And so we thought, having come to Egypt from China, it meant that my perspective is not just that of an American, of a Westerner. I also have quite a bit of Chinese perspective, because I was there for, you know, 11 intense years. I speak Chinese fluently. So it colors the way I see things. And I also got to know Chinese who had migrated to Egypt and who were working there and who were living very much at the grassroots level in small cities in Upper Egypt. And talking to them was really fascinating to me. And that's part of what gives this book, I think, a different perspective, because I was hearing from them as well as from the Egyptians and as well as from whatever foreigners and Americans who were there.
I think one of the other things that gives the book a different perspective is the types of characters who you interview for this book. I mean, there's a lot of government officials and protesters who are the sort of people we would expect to see as you're covering a political revolution. But you've also got these very, I think, personal and revealing stories within there about the interactions you have in your everyday life with people like the neighborhood garbage man or your translator who is living in the closet out of fear, your Arabic teacher who has this nostalgia for the way things were. So I'm curious how you sort of navigated that line between someone being a reporting subject or a source and then maybe bleeding over into a friendship.
you let the reader know what your relationship is, you know. So if this is and I like having a number of my stories, a number of my subjects develop spontaneously. You know, to me that's always an important part of my process, is not to pick subjects or things too far in advance. It's often what strikes you as interesting. And the garbage man, I became interested in him because he was bringing me things from the garbage that he would take out of, you know, he would find these things in the garbage of foreigners and other people, and things that were in English and things that were in Chinese, and he would bring them to me and ask me, you know, what is this? Can you tell me what this medicine is used for, and so on? And so I got interested. I realized he's going through this stuff in an incredibly intricate way. What's going on here? And so I started looking at the system, and it turned out it really actually said a lot about how Cairo functions, and also about, you know, the culture of people from Upper Egypt, because that's where his family was originally from. And so many Egyptians have this background. And it turned into something that was a friendship, but he was also a writing subject. And he taught me a great deal about the country.
Well, I'd love it if you'd read a little bit about what you wrote about your relationship with Saeed, this garbage man that you're describing. And I'll just give it a little bit of a background. So this scene is as he's preparing you to watch a soccer match with him, with a group of his friends who are mostly Coptic Christians. He's Muslim, and he's walking you through the mechanics of how you should go about addressing him. So would you pick it up there?
Yeah, and another thing that I would mention is the reason that this is complicated is that, so he's Muslim. Many garbage collectors in Cairo are Christian, and the reason that is the case is because they could have pigs, and the pigs could process the organic matter from the garbage. And so it's this really amazingly intricate niche that's culturally and religiously specific. So that's why this is charged, but I'll read you what I wrote here. Like so many aspects of Egyptian society, the garbage world involved endless complexities of social class, faith, and language. The first time Saeed invited me to his neighborhood to watch a soccer game with his Zebalin colleagues, most of whom were Copts, he prepped me carefully. He warned me not to say Salamu Alaikum to a Christian, and he reminded me to address any priest as Abuna, our father. At all costs, I should avoid using Muslim interjections like La ilaha illallah, there is no God but God. I enjoyed the strangeness of this exchange, the Muslim garbage man instructing the former Catholic altar boy on how to avoid offending Coptic Christian sensibilities.
I mean, it is kind of funny and strange in a way, but also sort of makes sense because you get an appreciation for the difference of culture, that just because maybe you were a Catholic altar boy at one time doesn't mean you understand Coptic Christians in Egypt. Is that sort of what makes you isolate this scene for us?
Yeah, no, I think it was also just funny how it was amazing me how aware he had to be. This was really his job. He's picking up garbage, and a lot of people think this is a low job, but it was intensely political, actually. Because first of all, he's a Muslim. Most of the people he's working with are Christians. He has to learn, you know, to be respectful of them, to understand their traditions. And so he had to negotiate that side. He was also kind of an amazing situation because he was not paid. There was no set fee for his work, which is one of the reasons why, for me, it struck me, because the first time he came to collect the bill for the month, I said, how much is he? He's like, how much do you want to pay? And then we started, and I said, well, how much do other people pay? Oh, sometimes they pay 10, sometimes they pay 100. There's a huge range. And it's like, he couldn't get him to narrow it down. And then I realized later, it's because his job just depends. If he does a good job and he can inspire you to feel obligated, you pay him. But there is no legal obligation. It's a totally informal system. And actually, many things in Egypt are like this. And it's sort of amazing that it functions. But that's also one reason why it's hard to change, because, you know, like 65% of the people in Cairo live in illegal housing. I mean, these are neighborhoods that are unplanned, basically unmonitored by the state. You know, you have a regime that we think of as authoritarian, but they often have actually very little authority on the ground. And a lot of people just kind of live lives that are disconnected from the state. It makes it hard to change, actually. It makes it hard to have a revolution, you know, when people are just used to doing their own thing.
You know, the pay what you want model, Peter, sounds a bit like public radio. This is what we do with our listeners, right? It's free to listen if you want, but we'd love for you to give, you know.
Yeah, but the garbage doesn't accumulate otherwise, which is sometimes right. What would happen. Like, sometimes people, like if a landlord in a building was having some conflict with a tenant, he would pay Saeed not to pick up the person's garbage.
Really?
Yeah, you know, to get leverage on him. And then once he'd get once the dispute had been settled, then he would pay Saeed to pick it all up. So it was very complicated, but it's really informal. And that's why it was amazing that this guy was in the middle of this very complicated cultural situation.
So Within your book, you sort of jump back and forth between different settings and different time periods. Some of the book takes place at these archaeological digs in Upper Egypt, which is actually what I remember from reading your initial New Yorker piece in 2013 by the same title, The Buried. Is that sort of what got the ball rolling? And then how did you sort of expand it out to be a full book?
Yeah, I've always been interested in archaeology, and actually in China, I wrote quite a bit about it as well. One of the things I feel when you're in these cultures with incredible ancient history is you do see a lot of connections. And it gives you a different perspective on what's going on now. And especially, this was such an intense political period to be there. You know, we arrived sort of in the wake of Mubarak's fall. I wasn't there when Mubarak was toppled, but that year we showed up. And so we were there for the first election and then the coup and all the other things that happened. And it can be, you can get a kind of tunnel vision. Sometimes on what's happening right now. It's all Muslim Brotherhood. It's all the military. And one of the nice things about going to the archaeological sites and spending time with the Egyptologists was it sort of forced me to step back a bit. And these were very peaceful places, too. There's no crowds. There's no chanting. You're in the desert. You know, you're looking at this you know, these incredible wastes and these archaeologists working very slowly, very methodically. It's very powerful. And they're uncovering evidence of these cultures, you know, from thousands of years ago. And one of them, for example, was a pharaoh named Akhenaten. And I would visit Barry Kemp, who was excavating Amarna, which was the capital that Akhenaten built. And he was like history's first revolutionary, some people say, because he radically tried to change the Egyptian faith, which had been stable for more than a millennium. This is in the 14th century BC. He decided, basically, it's the first time in recorded history that an individual takes a step toward monotheism. He wants to worship one god. And this was incredibly disruptive to the country. He built a new capital, and he tried to change the artistic patterns, all of these things. So it's basically like another example of a revolution. But when you look at it, you know, from the perspective of somebody in 2013, 2014, and when everything is going on in Tahrir, you really see these connections. You know, you see, and how did it end? It ended with the head of the military staging what may be the first coup in recorded history and taking over and ending that dynasty, which is kind of what we saw in 2013 when the Muslim Brotherhood year in power ended with a coup by the Minister of Defense, Sisi. The thing about the ancient Egyptians, we focus on the pyramids and all of these amazing monumental constructions, and that's natural. They are stunning. But, in some ways, their real genius was political. I mean, they were brilliant politicians. They were really good at creating a sense. I mean, first of all, just to have the sense of a nation is not something that people really had before the Egyptians, the sense that this is a people defined by a territory. We are one people. We are the Egyptians, and they created this powerful sense, the sense of a divine ruler. You know, many of these symbols that to us are very familiar, like the crown, the scepter, these are things that the Egyptians, pioneered, basically. It's believed that they were the first ones to develop these symbols. They used to have where the pharaoh lived, they would whitewash it, and they called it the white wall, which is just like the White House. They understood architecture is symbolic. You build the pharaoh's building, you paint it white, you put it where everybody sees it. You have something that's a focal point. They use nostalgia in brilliant ways. They were always declaring, for example, that after that pharaoh, Akhenaten, was overthrown, one of the ones who came after him, actually the next one who came after him, declared what they called a Wehem Mesut, which is a renaissance, which is we're going back. We're going back to the real Egypt. And this was something that pharaohs would often do after a period of instability. And it's the exact same thing. After Mubarak was overthrown and the Muslim Brotherhood came to power, they declared a Nahda, which in Arabic means renaissance. And it's not that different from what we have. I mean, we're sort of, have a revolutionary figure now, and it's make America great again. It's the same thing. We go back. It's a way of justifying change, justifying a degree of radicalism through the past, and this is a very sophisticated political strategy that they were using, 3,000 years ago, and we still use it today.
How does your time then in Egypt and maybe in China as well inform how you see what's going on in American politics today?
It's familiar, to some degree. I mean, I think this sense of nostalgia and that's very familiar. I think also the authoritarian, the power, the appeal of a strong ruler, of a strong man, is is really fundamental. You know, it's visceral. You know, this is something that we like to think that, you know, we're democratic, that we have moved beyond these sort of kind of crude manipulations that, that people were doing thousands of years ago. But it, it still really grabs people. You know, this idea. And I would talk to the archaeologists and they would say, you know, I've been working on this dig and looking at this pharaoh's history. And then when I see Sisi coming up, and it makes me think about this endless appeal of the strong male ruler, you know, and I feel that here often as well.
That's Peter Hessler. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his new book is called The Buried, An Archaeology of the Egyptian Revolution. Peter, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, how are you and your garden dealing with this weather? We'll take your calls next, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. If you've been outside lately, or just looked out the window, you know that May is the new March here in Boston. Sure, we got a tease of spring on Saturday, but otherwise the weather has been downright damp and cold. In fact, some parts of Massachusetts over the weekend got sleet and snow. Snow, people! And this is coming off an April that had the most rainy days of any month in Boston's recorded history. Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell hit the street this afternoon to ask some soggy citizens how they're holding up.
Terrible.
Well, I came from Vermont, and I was thinking it'd be better. And the first year I moved down here was the year that we had all those Monday snowstorms. And I was like, why did I come down here? It's only worse.
It's been horrible. It's miserable to get around. Like a five-minute walk becomes like this nightmare because, it's been lousy.
I am really sad about it. I'm gray. I was in Atlanta over the weekend, and it was really hot and sunny and beautiful. And I flew back last night. And it was raining and gross, and I needed to be summer so I can be happy again.
What is going on? And when will the drizzly doldrums end? What do all these cool, cloudy, rainy days mean for your gardens and landscaping? Let's ask David Epstein. He's WBUR's meteorologist. He's also a horticulturist and runs the website growingwisdom.com. David, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us is Zanna Porter. She's the Director of Operations at Green City Growers, which specializes in rooftop and urban farming. Zanna, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me today.
We're glad to have you. And listeners, we'd like you to join the conversation as well. Do you have gardening or landscaping questions for our guests? How has this weather been impacting your own gardening and your outdoor plans? And maybe you just need a place to vent about the weather. We're here for you. Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, David, let me begin with you. Just the nuts and bolts question that's on everybody's mind. When's it going to be over? Can you give us an update on the forecast? Are we going to be in the clear anytime soon?
Well, things look like they're going to warm up a little bit as we head towards the weekend. We're in basically a blocking pattern. This is something that a lot of forecasters thought would set up in February. If you look back at some of the winter forecasts, it was for more snow than we had. And it's because folks thought that this pattern would set up during the winter. And now that it's set up in the spring, we're having kind of what would be winter-like weather. So it's one of the reasons why it's been so cold. Temperatures today, only the sixth time we've stayed under 50 since 1872. So it really is quite cold. Interestingly enough, we have not been above average with rainfall in May. Believe it or not, it's been a little bit of rain almost every day. But when you add it up, we are smack dab pretty close to average in terms of rainfall this month.
Still, though, brutal. I mean, I said that May is the new March, and you're talking about February. That's no good. And speaking of February-like weather, we had a nor'easter the other day, Dave. Now, there was no snow, in at least in eastern Massachusetts, but how unusual is that to get a nor'easter in May?
The term nor'easter basically is a storm moving up the coastline, giving us northeasterly winds. So they do happen, but combined with the cold air and getting the snow, and even last night up in Maine, there was accumulating snow. There was a winter weather advisory in Vermont this morning from this nor'easter. So it's unusual, not unprecedented. May 9th, 10th, 1977, a foot of snow around the Worcester area. So we have seen crazy May weather before. thank goodness we didn't see any accumulating snow with this one around here.
All right. Zanna Porter, so it could be worse. We didn't get that foot of snow in May, thank goodness. But I'm wondering what the impact is, especially on the type of farming that you specialize in, this rooftop and urban farming. I imagine there are some special challenges that go with that anyway. How is the new, the recent weather affecting what you folks do at Green City Growers?
You know, it certainly is having some effect. Fortunately, in an urban landscape where we grow, we're in somewhat modified protected areas. You know, we're growing in raised beds. We're growing on rooftops that have, you know, microclimates. We also engineer good drainage. We've got irrigation. So when we have the opposite problem we're having now with drought, we're able to deal with those issues as well. But everything is coming on a little more slowly than normal. And, you know, what is normal? But we are seeing plants going in the ground that just are not growing very quickly. So there's certainly, we are seeing the effects of the weather. You always see the effects of the weather in the plants. And this year, so far, it seems everything is just coming on a little bit more slowly.
All right. As I mentioned, you're welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The segment is really for you, people. If you need some advice or you need to just vent, you can do it here. And Trish is calling from Topsfield. She's got a question. What are you wondering about there, Trish?
Yes, hi. I got some hydrangeas on Mother's Day, and I'm afraid to plant them because it's been so cold, especially at night. I put them outside in like a bigger planter, and I was planning to do that instead of putting them right into the ground. But, yeah, I'm just afraid it's too cold, and I'll lose the flowers. And what do you suggest?
So the hydrangeas, it depends on where she got them. So if you got a hydrangea at, say, a garden center, most of those are hardy around here for 12 months of the year. Some of the sort of Mother's Day hydrangeas that are big and blue and pink, they're not necessarily hardy in this climate. So what that means is you can put them out now, no, either way, but you have to be careful to be sure that it's a hardy plant so that it comes back next year. But I think temperatures right now, we're not going to see a frost or a freeze, so it'll be fine out there. The rain, actually, if it's heavy, hurts the blossoms more than the cold weather over the next few days.
I just want to point out, though, you were supposed to get your hydrangeas from WBUR during the Mother's Day fundraiser, just to be clear. Zanna, one thing I'm wondering, though, is about just sort of if there can be too much of a good thing. I mean, we've had a drought just a couple of years ago during this time of year, and that causes its own problems for gardening and whatnot. So, I mean, is one better than the other? Is all this rain a welcome development for gardeners, or is it too much of a good thing, as I said?
There always can be too much of a good thing, certainly. You know, as a farmer, you know, there was always the issue of a drought is terrible. The only thing worse is a flood because you can't actually get rid of the water. You can irrigate and deal with drought. So certainly, you know, and all the moisture is affecting our soils. It's affecting the microbes in the soil and how they're behaving. So, again, we're seeing that in our plants just growing more slowly and the, you know, affecting getting into the ground. If it's really, really saturated, you can't be walking in your garden. You're going to be compacting the soils. So, you know, there's a lot to consider. I don't think we're at the threshold yet of too much of a good thing. It's being conscious of where you're planting your plants and not planting them in the wettest part of your garden, certainly.
All right, let's hear from Lindsay in Westford. Lindsay, congratulations. I understand you're a new homeowner, but now you have a question for our guest. What are you wondering about?
I am. Thank you. So my question is, being a first-time homeowner, I'm having a yard for the first time. And it's been fun to see all of the bulbs come up and everything like that, but I'm also seeing a lot of weeds in my grass, and I don't know what to do about that.
Well, that's a good question there, Lindsay. Let's take it up with our next guest. I want to bring in Wayne Mezzett. He's the owner of Weston Nurseries, and he's also the chairman of the board of the Massachusetts Horticultural Society. Wayne, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank
so what about Lindsay's question there? She says she's a first-time homeowner. She's got a yard for the first time.
Yes.
She's excited about that, but now she's got all these weeds. What can she do?
That's what happens when you get this type of weather. One of the things that lawn management people do is to use chemicals to kill the broadleaf weeds and to prevent germination of the weeds that come in the summertime, like crabgrass. That's a possibility, or you can, what my wife does actually is going out there with a little tool and digs out the dandelions and the and the other broadleaf weeds when you see them. And if you keep them under control enough, 1 year, they don't come back. If they don't seed, they don't come back as heavily the next year.
And Wayne, let me ask you just from a business standpoint. I mean, a lot of folks go to Weston Nurseries this time of year to get everything that they need to begin their springtime gardening. Are folks doing that less this season because they're discouraged by the weather? What's business like?
It's interesting. The garden center has been pretty busy. Of course, when it rains, people have a tendency to stay away and nestle down in their homes because it's not as pleasant to be outside. But everything outside is so beautiful this year because we have had such cool weather. The forsythia, for example, stayed in bloom for a month. How often does that happen? So it's really beneficial in terms of enjoying the landscape, not so good for the retailers.
All right. As you might expect, we do have a deluge of phone calls coming in on this segment. Dylan is calling from Somerville with a question that I think maybe Zanuck can help with. Dylan, what are you wondering?
Hi. Yes, my girlfriend and I are first-time gardeners this year, growing in about a 6x6 box on our flat rooftop, and wondering about some do's and don'ts with this wet weather and growing from seedlings versus seeds.
All right, Dylan, thanks for the ring. Zanna, how about it? This is your area of expertise. What can Dylan do?
Absolutely. I mean, the world is your oyster, Dylan, and that's a great opportunity to have a rooftop spot in Somerville. You know, you want to begin with thinking about your soils. Healthy plants come from healthy soils. And so making sure that you have proper drainage and installing an irrigation system, I definitely recommend. You don't want to be up there twice a day during July watering your tomatoes, trying to keep them alive. That's not much fun. At least I don't think that's what you want to be doing with your time. You know, there are benefits to direct seeding versus transplanting. Transplanting, you're going to get a little bit ahead of any weeds that you might be finding in your soils. You're also, you know, you're ahead of time a little bit, you know, putting a transplant in that was started in a greenhouse. It's going to be ahead when you put it out in the soils. So you might see your fruiting crops a little bit earlier. Things like tomatoes are going to do much better as a transplant versus direct seed. Crops that will do well as direct seeds, arugulas, lettuce mixes, radishes, and those are great crops to start with because they have a short period of time that they're in the soil before they're ready to harvest, and so you get almost immediate results for your hard work. And so there's that feedback loop of satisfaction of putting something in the ground and being able to harvest it fairly quickly, as opposed to like a potato, which is going to be in the ground for, you know, 90 to 120 days. That's a long-term investment.
We're talking about the rainy, dreary weather and gardening with David Epstein. He is the WBUR meteorologist and also a horticulturist. We're also speaking with Zanna Porter, who's the director of operations at Green City Growers, and Wayne Mezzett, who is the owner of Weston Nurseries and chairman of the board of the Massachusetts Horticultural Society. And we'd love to hear from you as well. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I don't know, maybe we're complaining too much about this weather. It can't all be bad, right? Stephen is calling from Norton. Stephen, are we whining too much?
Hi. No, I wouldn't say it's too whining, but, you know, down here, the weather hasn't been too bad for most of my crops, but it's not too variant from the weather that we usually get around here this time of the season. It's a little bit less sunny, and I haven't been too good for my marijuana crop, but, you know, sometimes it was just like that. But, yeah, so I was going to say, thank you very much for having me on your radio show.
All right, Stephen, thanks for the ring. So Stephen doesn't seem to think the weather is too bad. And, you know, we heard some of the tape from Zoe Mitchell, our producer, who was out on the street talking to folks earlier today. And Stephen's not alone. There were some folks who said this rainy weather isn't so bad.
I have a six-year-old, so, you know, lots of movies and lots of trying to get out of the house like we do in January, right? Sports get canceled, and, right, the spring season is kind of short, and this really shortens it.
Just been working out, hanging out, trying to do yard work, but that's obviously holding everything back due with the weather. So just, you know, hopefully we get a nice weekend for the long weekend coming up.
I like the weather. The trees, nice green, fresh feel. And yes, of course, the coming of the flowers is wonderful.
So how about that, David Epstein? I mean, not everybody is depressed because of the bad weather. And if there's one other silver lining that I've read about, it's that tick bites are down so far this season. Maybe just because people are staying indoors, they're not going out. But how do you see things?
Yeah, it you know, there's opportunity anytime that it's wet like this. I mean, one of the things that I was doing yesterday was moving some perennials and some shrubs that typically this time of the year you probably couldn't move because the sun's very strong. The sun right now is strong as it would be in July. But because it's been cool and damp, if you see something in your garden, perhaps it's a, you know, a clump of something that you want to move from A to B, you can do that at least for a couple of more days with all the cool, wet weather. Also, things that were planted back in late March and early April, there are some things that are enjoying this. I harvested a bunch of radishes yesterday, the arugulas, the kales, all those things are thriving a little bit. They're a little slower, but they're still doing pretty well. So there are cool, damp weather crops that, you know, they're not thriving as much as they would, but they're doing pretty well. Last year, we had 11 days at 80 or higher in May. So just a very different May this year.
All right. Let's take another question from our callers. Ed is in New Market, New Hampshire. Ed, what are you wondering about?
Yeah. Hi. I planted two gorgeous paper bark maples either late July or early August of last year. And you know, I had read quite a bit about them, that they're relatively rare, but they're becoming slightly more popular. And I paid an arm and a leg for them because they're fairly good caliper. Dug beautiful holes, put them in the ground, had a great display through the summer and especially into the fall. Then the bark all wintertime was gorgeous. But so far this spring, and I live 60 miles north of Boston, I acknowledge that, but there's not a trace of any new growth on the tree.
Thanks for the ring, Ed. So Wayne Mezzett from Weston Nurseries, what about that? Do you have any guidance for Ed? He's got these beautiful new trees that he says he spent handsomely on. What can he do to help him grow this spring?
A lot of trees are later leafing out than others, and that may be the situation with yours, especially if it's just planted last year. But chances are it's okay. What I'd recommend is to scratch the bark on the twigs and the stems. And if they're bright green, it will come along. It will throw out new leaves pretty soon. It seems unlikely if they were planted in that early in the year. We had enough rain last year, and providing they didn't dry out. If they dried out at any point during the summer or the fall, that could put stress on them. But chances are they're just a little bit late leafing out.
All right. Mike is in Londonderry, New Hampshire. He's got a question that I know Dave Epstein can handle. What are you wondering about, Mike?
I live in a property where there's a lot of rhododendron family shrubs, and I'm seeing lots and lots of brown leaves, which is a little unusual. Is that weather-related or something else?
Interesting question. Actually, Wayne and I were talking about this just a couple of days ago. I think one of the problems that happened with some of the rhododendron this year was that we had some warmer weather during the winter in which the ground was frozen solid. The air temperature got up to 40 or even a little bit higher. So those plants actually need a little bit of moisture and they couldn't get it. So some of those leaves dried out. As Wayne suggested, you really want to do that scratch test. Those branches still could be alive and they may just shed those leaves and new leaves flush out. You may have lost the flower blossoms. So the flower blossoms and the actual leaf blossoms are different. So those may not happen and it may not come out. If you know, by the time we get to mid-June, those still look horrible and you haven't seen any new growth flushing out, at that point I would sort of cut it back to where it looks fairly green. And it'll take a couple of years, but they're pretty hardy plants.
And if folks are wondering how to do that test, I know, Dave, I knew that question was good for you because you've got this whole video with the rhododendron on growingwisdom.com, right, where you show us how to look at the leaves and bend the branch and see if the plant is actually dead or if it may come back.
Right. Sometimes they just do come back. I have a red bud right now that is similar to the paper bark maple. It hasn't leafed out yet. I'm holding out hope, and I'm going to leave it for a little while.
All right. Russ is calling from Cambridge. Russ, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind is I had a total failure of my tomatoes that I've been growing for 7 or 8 years straight with success. Last year, I think the chipmunks and the squirrels took every one of them. They ate one half and left me nothing. I don't know what changed. But you have any clues?
Zanna, any clues there? Is this something that you see a lot even in urban farming where the chipmunks raid the garden?
Absolutely. We do see a lot of pest pressure. You know, there are various methods that you can take to try and protect your crops. They seem to take one bite out of every single fruit. You know, I wish they'd just take one and be done. But, you know, they want to sample every one. And in urban settings, we do see a lot of chipmunks. We see groundhogs from time to time. We even see deer. You know, at Green City Growers, we put pest fencing around our raised beds even to help raise the distance that whatever critter has to take to get up into the bed. There's also, you know, there's different materials you can sprinkle around the edges of your bed. If you're in an area that's seeing a lot of construction, there is a lot of development happening around this area currently. You could see other pests coming in, more mice, even city rats if you're living in a very industrial area. So definitely recommending, you know, some sort of physical barrier will be beneficial. That's where we see the best results.
Wayne Mezzett, any closing advice for our gardeners who are listening? I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of you, but I think a lot of folks are just wondering whether they've just, you know, used up all the rain here at the beginning of the season and what the outlook is going to be for the rest of the year. What are your best tips in the final moments that we have?
I think this is a great time to enjoy the spring season, because this cooler weather extends all the color and all the enjoyment that we're seeing. Everything seems to be in bloom at once. When the weather warms up, it's going to be an explosion. We're going to see a lot more growth than usual because of all the length of time the plants have had to recover. And when summer gets here, just remember, it's going to be hot and humid again. Not so much fun working outside.
That's right. Yeah, I guess that's the upside to it. Enjoy the cool working weather while you've got it. Wayne Mezzett, owner of Weston Nurseries and chairman of the board of the Massachusetts Horticultural Society, thanks a lot for your time today.
You're welcome.
Zanna Porter, director of operations at Green City Growers, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And also our thanks to WBUR meteorologist David Epstein. Dave, any final sunny outlook for us here, or are we going to just be raining the rest of the week?
Saturday's looking pretty good right now. Fingers crossed.
All right. Holding out for Saturday. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Eve Zukoff, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.